And I will now call the next case. Ansel Johnson versus Sam Culpepper. And we have Mark Gritsmacher for the appellant. Mr. Gritsmacher, you're on mute.
Good morning, Your Honor. Am I here?
You may proceed, yes.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Gritsmacher, and I represent the appellant, Ansel Johnson. After nearly 6 years diligently contesting the legality of his incarceration through the Florida court system, often pro se from prison, the Florida District Court of Appeal finally recognized that the basis underlying Mr. Johnson's sentence was error. In so doing, the Florida District Court of Appeal explicitly directed that a resentencing hearing was to take place so that Mr. Johnson could determine the true nature of his sentence and specifically so that the state could determine whether there was any other basis for his habitual felony offender status. That sentencing hearing never occurred. This appeal asks whether it was error for the district court to dismiss with prejudice and without leave to amend Mr. Johnson's civil rights claims flowing from that illegal incarceration on the district court's presumption that it was obvious when Mr. Johnson was released from prison that he wouldn't be resentenced, that he didn't plead otherwise, and therefore that his claims started to accrue at the moment he was released from prison. The answer to that question is yes. The district court's presumptions were error, and so were the legal conclusions that flowed from it.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you've got a lot of interesting arguments. I think that it's, for my part, speaking only for myself, I disagree with the district court's conclusion that it was obvious that he would be resentenced. But so let's say that we disagree with that conclusion. Then walk me through where you go from there under Wallace and Heck.
Yes, Judge Grant, I'd be happy to. So I think there are then two bases for establishing the timeliness of his claims that are set out in his complaint. I think first, as an initial matter, under this court's discovery rule applicable to 1983 claims, it was not reasonably apparent to Mr. Johnson that there were facts supporting a complete and present cause of action at the moment of his release from prison. I think that's the case for several reasons. First and foremost, he has a decision from the Florida District Court of Appeal explicitly stating he's going to be resentenced, he's going to attend a resentencing hearing. Now, that's an entitlement under Florida law that he is entitled to attend the resentencing hearing. Second, that never occurred. And in fact, Mr. Johnson pleads he was simply released in the middle of the night without any understanding of whether or not he was going to attend a resentencing hearing. In fact, he pleads to this day that he was never resentenced. And then I would say third, there are also facts and allegations about the fact that, or excuse me, I should be careful and say, we know from the record that he was represented by counsel. And I think there's an additional component here that if he was never informed, it would be reasonable for a plaintiff under his circumstances not to know at the exact moment he's released from prison in the middle of the night, as he alleges, that he has an injury, there's no other basis for his incarceration, and so the clock starts running on his constitutional claims at that moment.
But he had been asserting that he had been wrongfully imprisoned for a long time. Didn't he know at the time of his release that he had been wrongfully imprisoned for at least 10 months and 11 days?
So even though he knew in some sense, and he had been fervently advocating that he'd been wrongfully imprisoned for a long time, I think there are a couple important legal principles at play here. One is Heck v. Humphrey and the fact that his constitutional claims actually go to the validity of his incarceration. And so I think in fact, Mr. Johnson filed a habeas petition after the decision came down. And I think there's a relationship here between he wasn't even allowed to file his constitutional claims until at least when his previous sentence had been terminated since it had been formally vacated. I don't think that was evident when he was released. I think it's actually it's not uncommon for a defendant not to be imprisoned while still awaiting sort of the finality of sentencing or his conviction. So I think speaking specifically to the running of the clock, no, I think there is leeway here between when he's released and when eventually, maybe it's more reasonable to conclude I'm not going to be resentenced and there's no basis for my continued incarceration.
What about the fact that he had been represented by the Office of the Public Defender? And I know that the office had moved to withdraw, but the court never took action on that. Surely, he could have contacted the public defender's office to find out the status of any resentencing.
So I think Judge Branch, consistent with Leal and other cases like this, I think we just don't have a fully developed factual record on this relationship with counsel at the time. I think it's clear from his allegations in the complaint that he alleges he's never been resentenced. So I think he was never informed. I think it's a fair reading of the complaint that he was never informed of the fact that his hearing had been waived. And so I think the relationship between him and his counsel candidly isn't fully developed in his allegations. But I think what is clear is that he was not informed that it was reasonable for him, given whatever, putting aside whatever acrimony or whatever relationship between him and his counsel was at the time, the fact that he wasn't informed only supports the reasonableness of his confusion surrounding the finality of the District Court of Appeals judgment. And if I may, I think that, there are two bases under the law for establishing the timeliness of his claims here. So I think we've been talking some about accrual, but I think even if the court decides that accrual occurred after the court's Florida District Court of Appeals decision or after he was released from prison, I think this falls right in the heart of the line of cases talking about a petitioner being misled. And I think, this goes exactly to your question, Judge Branch, is I think when you have a decision instructing one thing, the precedent's clear that it's not unreasonable for a petitioner to believe that the decision, the instructions of the decision will be carried out. And I think you compare that here with the fact that he was represented by counsel, and the record's not fully developed on the relationship of what happened between him and his counsel. But I think that actually only underscores the reasonableness of his confusion and having a direction from the Florida District Court of Appeal, and then having a sentencing supposedly waived without his notice.
When do you contend the statute of limitations started to run?
So Judge Schoflat, I would say that the court doesn't need to have a precise date. I do think it was at least 3 months after he was released from prison, which would make his claims timely. And I think, the court has said in the context of the Knight v. Schofield decision, for example, tolling means just what it says. The clock is stopped while tolling is in effect. So I think if tolling occurs, or if the reasonableness of, the facts he is aware of make it reasonable that he knows he has a complete and present injury, I think both of those.
You say sometimes after 3 months, is that it?
Yes, sir. I think that's all that's required.
Well, what happened to start it sometime after 3 months?
It's a fair question, Judge Schoflat. And I would say that, at some point when he wasn't resentenced and when he wasn't, contacted by counsel, I think Mr. Johnson, it's clear he filed these complaints. I think at some point it would have become reasonable for him to understand that he wasn't going to be resentenced. And in fact, there's no basis for his continued incarceration. And, I think in Knight v. Schofield, actually, there was a decision from the Supreme Court of Georgia. It wasn't passed down to the petitioner with respect to his federal habeas petition. And the court there says that even after a year, he started to kind of realize something was amiss, and he contacted the court, and he realized that even though the court said it would notify him, he was never notified of the decision. And the court here said that was fair, that was reasonable. So here, I don't even think you need a year, but I think there were at least a matter of months where, it would have been fair for someone in Mr. Johnson's shoes not to have known, and then at some point, maybe it's the facts are there and it's reasonable then to at least call and figure out whether or not he would ever be resentenced.
Go ahead, Judge Grant.
How would his claim have looked different after resentencing than it would have looked the day after he was released?
So if I understand your question correctly, you know, I think his claim from a tolling perspective or from a
substantive merits perspective, what is different about his claim after resentencing than before resentencing, but after release?
You know, Mr. Johnson, I think kind of includes within his due process violations the fact that his claim, not only was his sentence void, but there was actually no resolution of his sentence. And so I think there is an extent to which his due process violations, at least as he's pleaded, you know, it's reasonable to read that he is including the fact that he never was entitled to a resentencing hearing. He's just left in limbo. But I don't think I think the heart of his claim certainly is the fact that he was unlawfully incarcerated for what could have been over 3.5-4 years, because his minimum guidelines we know were only about 16 months. So if that doesn't answer your question, I'm happy to elaborate.
So I think in either case, the day after he was released, he could have raised a claim for his wrongful detention, right? And after he was resentenced, he could have raised a claim for his wrongful detention, perhaps for a longer period of time. Is the idea that the court would have nunk-pro-tunk somehow potentially cut his sentence lower than 5 years even?
So I think that's right. But I would also just say, I think it's our position that it's not so clear whether he has a complete claim at the moment of his release, simply because cases like Heck and the precedent following it, Wallace v. Cato, and these cases are pretty clear that you have to be careful about bringing a 1983 claim until it's invalidated and until your sentence is invalidated and you've sort of proven that your the sentencing or the conviction that your 1983 allegations are going toward has been invalidated by the courts. So I think part of it is just a finality concern here of when he's released in the middle of the night, as he claims, it's not entirely clear that his previous sentence has been invalidated. In fact, the District Court of Appeals explicitly says that the lower court was wrong to deny his illegal sentence motion. But I think the Court of Appeal could have at that moment, it had the authority to, you know, just say, release him immediately, his sentence is void, and he should have only been sentenced to the lower end of the guidelines. He had guidelines in place, and Florida law actually gives the Florida Court of Appeals authority to do something like a nunk-pro-tunk from the Court of Appeals. I think here it was explicitly, no, he needs to go back and have a resentencing. We're not exactly sure of the contours of his sentence, and I think that wasn't finalized when he was released in the middle of the night, according to him.
So he would contend that he, at the time of his release, was not aware that his sentence had been invalidated. And so therefore he needed to wait for resentencing to determine whether if the government, say, had another predicate, so they could have resentenced him to 10 years, then at that point he doesn't have a claim for wrongful imprisonment. But if the court had said in a hearing with him present, correct, you were wrongfully imprisoned, you should have only been imprisoned for a maximum of 5 years, then he does.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but I think at that point, yes, his claims would start to run at least. And, you know, Mr. Johnson, I don't think was thinking in terms of Wallace v. Cato when he was released in the middle of the night, but I want to be sensitive to the fact that he firmly believed that he had a claim as he was litigating from prison for 5 years, 5.5 years, waiting for a decision affirming the fact that he was illegally incarcerated. I think from a matter of accrual, and I just want to make that distinction to not speak for Mr. Johnson, but as a matter of accrual, though, I think you're exactly right. I think that when he was released in the middle of the night, in fact, to this day, he says, my sentence is like void. I know it's wrong, but I don't know what my sentence is. And so I think there is an issue of finality for purposes of Wallace v. Cato and Heck v. Humphrey and when the accrual clock would start. But at the same time, I think he firmly believed that the decision was error, or his sentencing was error and unlawful, and that his constitutional claims flow from that.
Counsel, one quick question. You are claiming part of equitable tolling that he filed in the wrong forum in Texas. What are we to make, if anything, of the fact that that was dismissed for failure to prosecute?
So Judge Branch, I think that's a great point. And if you may, I might run a little bit over time to answer your question.
Please do.
I actually think that's another error of the district court. The district court sort of, again, said it was obvious, it's the wrong venue, it was dismissed. He didn't even raise this as, I think it said explicitly raise this. All three of those things are wrong. So in fact, he had filed his complaint. He was granted informa pauperis status. And then I think that the case was reassigned to a different judge and just sat there on the docket. It wasn't dismissed for failure to prosecute until after the district court's ruling below here. So in actuality, he did have a pending case, which the district court recognized came from the exact same set of facts and legal claims. And then I would also just contend that he explicitly made this point in his objections to the R&R and in his original complaint that he had a pending case that was related in the objection of the R&R. He mentioned it, I think, four times, trying to argue that he's been trying, he's already filed these claims, they're related. And I think the district court just, it was a very uncharitable reading of the complaint and frankly just diametrically opposed to this court's precedent of how we treat pro se plaintiffs.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. We have your case under submission.